be an effective parent, surely allowing her time to bond with her son or daughter should be crucial. I'm cataloging all the points to this argument as I storm toward the door, ready to confront this judge as soon as I catch up to him. But Bernie steps in front of me as I leave Annie's room, and she says flatly, "Whatever you're about to do, don't even think about it." But if they'd just give her some more time, however bad this is, speaking out of session to that judge is going to make it worse. But this is all bullshit. It's not right. We have to appeal. This isn't law and order, Alexis. There is no appeal. I told you this is a juvenile court hearing. Judge Brown has made his decision, and we need to find a way to make it work now. Make it work? I repeat, but I'm outraged and my voice is too loud, and other staff members are starting to stare at me in the corridor. Bernie pushes me into Annie's room and closes the door behind us. She leans against it, as if I might physically burst past her into the corridor, and I close my arms over my chest and glare at her. And suddenly I'm angry with Bernie, too. She should have warned me that this might all happen quickly. I should have known to prepare Annie for this. Okay, so they've thrown the book at you, Annie, Bernie concedes. But rehab is actually a good idea, right? Annie, you want to get clean, don't you? Well, maybe the timing isn't ideal, but this will give you a chance to complete a rehab program and be clean and ready to get your life together before the baby is old enough to notice you're even gone. I can't let my one-week-old baby go into fucking foster care, Annie says, and she's snarling at Bernie, who raises her eyebrows and says quite calmly, "Foster care or kinship care, Annie?" What the fuck is kinship care? Annie demands. And suddenly everyone is staring at me. I feel the flush creeping up my face. I should have thought about this, too. I should have run the idea by Sam. I should have been better prepared. I stare at Bernie, and my vision goes blurry. And then I turn back to Annie and I whisper, "It means the baby would go to a family member. Until you're ready to care for it." A family member. We both know what that means. Annie would never allow the baby to go to the community, even if Mom wanted it, and even if Mom did, Robert would never allow that. Which leaves only one possible person if kinship care really is the way to go. "You?" Annie whispers, and the tears are rolling down her face. And she wraps her arms around her belly as she chokes. "Would you do that for me? I can't ask that of you." "The baby will probably be in the hospital for some time as we manage the NAS symptoms," Eliza points out. But I hear her only from a distance, because I'm staring into my sister's eyes. She said she couldn't ask this of me, but her gaze is pleading. And without a single word, that's exactly what she's doing. "How long did you say the rehab program will be?" I ask, as the buzzing in my ears grows louder. Maybe if it's only a month, the baby will be in the NICU the whole time. 90 days. 3 months? There's no way the baby will be in the NICU that long. That means the baby would need to come home with me. Probably for several months. "Could you, Lexi? Would you? Please?" I should check with Sam. I know I should check with Sam. But Annie is breathless with desperate hope. So I rush to the bed and I take her hands in mine and I whisper, "Of course I will."
10. Annie. "Luke, you made me cry this morning. That's not easy, so I'll give you credit. What you said gave me a lot to think about. You're right, I do carry a lot of shame. In fact, even writing that made me angry. Because for me, shame and anger are always entwined. If I'm angry, you can bet your ass that something made me feel ashamed first. It's just how it works. I'm easily embarrassed. I'm self-conscious. I'm well aware of the catastrophic disaster my life has become. And it's heavy. Shame is heavy on me. It's crushing, suffocating. That doesn't mean I don't deserve it. I'm still crying. Fuck, I hate this. Well, while I'm already a mess, I may as well tell you about Robert. I hate writing his name, you know. I hate saying it, too. There was a period of a few years when I was estranged altogether from Mom when I just refused to say that name aloud. It would stick in my throat, and I'd almost gag if I tried. I digress, so let me pick up where I left off in the last entry. We learned more about him over the weeks before the wedding. He was a widower. His first wife had died in childbirth along with his infant son. He spoke about his first wife and lost child freely, but with an odd sense of distance from the loss.
It was the Lord's will, just like your father's passing. Who am I to question it? It was their time.
Lexi and I found this sense of acceptance to be maddening, particularly when he started to expect it from us. Any time we complained about the forthcoming move, he responded with rapidly increasing impatience, as if we were being completely unreasonable. Mom wasn't much better. She was excited about the move and renewed contact with her family, and she couldn't seem to understand why we weren't.
But you'll see your grandmothers and aunts and uncles every day, girls. It's going to be so much easier on us all.
So much easier on you, you mean? I snapped at her a few times, and each time I was promptly punished with time in my room alone. This gave me time to think about all of the ways that this move was going to ruin my life, and time to panic about moving away from the house that contained all of my memories of my father. I'd lie on the floor and sob, but if I thought really hard about Dad, I'd always catch a sense of him in the room with me. It was a tiny glimmer, just a hint of his presence, but it was generally enough to calm me. I'd think about Lexi's words the day of his funeral, and I'd remind myself again and again that Dad would never leave us. He just wouldn't. I took some comfort in the idea that whatever was coming, Dad would somehow be watching over me. And I was certainly seeing his family, and Mom's, more than I ever had before. Mom kept taking us to Winterton to visit with them, trying to help us adjust, I think. Winterton was a quiet little village with ordinary-looking houses and a main street with average businesses. I suppose if you looked closely enough, you'd realize something is off about it. It's perhaps a little too neat, a little too tidy. All of the residents are sect families. All of the businesses are run by its members. And the church runs the only school in the village. And so, all of the men you see in Winterton are clean-shaven with very short, neat hair. And almost all of the women look similar, too, with long hair beneath headscarves and extremely modest clothing. There are no run-down homes, and almost everyone has a new car, and there's virtually no unemployment. The church offers interest-free loans to its members to establish or develop their own businesses, so the main street of Winterton has a surprisingly wide variety of stores, and there's even an industrial area. It's not exactly a closed community. There are no gates at the town entrance, and the regional city of Collinsville, where we'd grown up, was only 5 miles away. Some Winterton residents run businesses in Collinsville, and I'd eventually realize that Collinsville residents like to visit Winterton for the stores. It's a nice place, and its residents are, for the most part, good-hearted, well-meaning people, with close ties to their community and a fierce dedication to their faith. Even so, Winterton is not a welcoming place. Members of the sect are never allowed to eat with non-believers, so while there are restaurants, only community members can utilize them. Exclusions like this exist all around. Even if an outsider wanted to move into the village, they'd find it almost impossible to be employed there or find housing. And while the men took turns participating in street preaching over in Collinsville to share their faith, this generally amounted to a group of them standing on the steps of the post office, shouting Bible verses at passers-by on a Saturday morning. If evangelism was the goal, this activity was an endless failure. I never saw them actually convert to the faith, and visitors were not welcome in the services. The congregation was totally stable, with a periodic exception of new children born or members forced out. But those on the inside of the sect are cared for in a way that most people in the outside world never experience. It's a restrictive lifestyle, but for those who comply perfectly, Winterton offers a tight-knit community. I'm convinced that's what Mom was seeking. After she lost Dad,
She wanted to return to the close embrace of the somewhat sheltered world she'd grown up in. I can still remember the shock I felt the first time Robert took us to his house. By then, we'd heard him speak from the pulpit quite a few times, so I'd wrapped my head around his seniority in the sect. His uncle had once been the head of the sect for all of its assemblies worldwide, and the closest thing to clergy the church had, because there were no pastors or priests. All ministry was done by the men in the church, and where decisions needed to be made, the board of elders took responsibility collectively. At some point during Mom and Dad's exile, Robert's once illustrious uncle had also been withdrawn from. That rejection is considered to be the worst fate that can befall a member of the sect. All ties are cut with a member who is withdrawn from. Prohibitive clauses in their interest-free loans are called in and access to their own family is restricted. And then intense intimidation is used to drive them from their homes and the village. But Robert had escaped his uncle's controversy unscathed and was now on the board of elders. All of the women in the assembly seemed to think Mom was quite lucky to be marrying him. His house was enormous, but it was sterile. Like all other community homes, there was no television or radio. But in Robert's house, there was also no sense at all that this was a home. Mom had decorated our real home so beautifully, with soft furnishings and photographs and artwork, and throw blankets on the couches and cushions and knickknacks. The sterile, whitewashed walls of Robert's home disturbed me almost as much as the idea of living in the community did. "It needs a feminine touch," Mom admitted to Lexi and me as we slowly packed the life we'd shared with Dad into moving boxes. "But give me a few months and I'll make that place feel like home for you. It's a beautiful house, so much potential." But as the wedding day neared, Robert was at our real home more and more, and he became increasingly involved in our decisions about what to take and what to throw out. He deemed the most innocent of possessions worldly, and showing any sign of attachment to something was a surefire way to have him declare it as an idol and insist that it make its way into the trash. Even Lexi, who was so good at flying under Robert's radar, got into a few teary arguments with him about what she was or wasn't to take. In the end, he insisted that we whittle our entire house of possessions down to only a handful of boxes. By moving day, all that followed me from my old life to my new one was a box of clothing, a few teddy bears, and a handful of books, including, thankfully, my precious journal. When the truck pulled up to his house, one final shock was in store. When Lexi asked where our room was, Robert shook his head.
"In my home, you'll have separate rooms."
"The girls have always shared a room, Robert," Mom said hesitantly.
"I'm the head of this house, Deborah. The girls will have their own rooms."
"Maybe they could share just for a while until they get used to—"
"No,"
Robert said flatly, and then he turned on his heel and went back outside to the truck. Lexi and I looked to Mom, who stared back at us helplessly.
"I'm sorry, girls. We need to respect Robert's wishes."
I sobbed as I set up my new bedroom. In the house we grew up in, Lexi and I had beds side by side in a big bedroom with pink walls and beautiful lace curtains that Mom had sewn herself. In the new house, our rooms were at separate ends of a long hall. The walls in our rooms were white, and the few belongings I had been allowed to keep did nothing at all to make my room feel mine. I felt utter disconnection from everything I had ever known, from the very first moments in that place, like a plant torn from the earth. The roots of my soul were exposed. At dinner that night, Robert fired one final pre-wedding missive.
"From tomorrow," he said, "you'll both call me father."
"I'm so sorry, Robert, but we can't do that," Lexi said automatically. It was the first time I'd heard her defy Robert, but in typical Lexi fashion, she did it with the utmost respect.
"This is my home. Your mother will be my wife. You will be my children, and you'll address me appropriately," Robert said.
Lexi took a careful breath, and she said quietly, "Dad is, and always will be, my father." "I can't call you it either," I said, and I glanced at Mom to find she was pleading with us with her eyes.
"Well, you won't eat my food unless you give me the respect I deserve," Robert snapped. "Go to your rooms."
"Mom?" I whispered.
but Mom was staring at her plate. The smile was gone. Mom was back to being fragile, and she withheld herself from us again, just as she had during that awful year of near silence after Dad's death. Fine, Lexi snapped, and she ran from the table, so I followed her. We lay together on her bed, and she wrapped her arms around me. We'll find a way to get out of here, she promised me. Mom will come to her senses, you'll see. What if she doesn't? I don't know. We'll find a way. It wasn't long before Robert threw the door open and insisted that I go to my own room. Lexi held on to me, her fingers digging into my waist, her body shaking against mine. I cowered in her arms as he shouted at us.
This is my home. Your children, female children. You will learn your place here. This filthy, worldly disrespect has no place in this house.
Until that night, I'd never really heard an adult scream at a child in fury. Robert's thundering voice was violence to my ears, and I eventually released my hold on Lexi to cover them to block the sound out. As I did so, Robert tried to drag me out of Lexi's arms, and Mom appeared in the doorway. Please, Robert, she begged, and we all fell silent. When I looked to her, I was surprised to see Mom was crying too. Please, let them share a room just until they settle in. This is such a change for them, and they have so much to adjust to. I'm sure the girls will agree to call you father if you let them share a room. Right, girls? I looked to Lexi next. We held a conversation with our tear-filled eyes. I simply could not bear the thought of walking down that corridor on my own and climbing into a cold bed without Lexi nearby to comfort me. Everything might be wrong with our lives now, but as long as Lexi and I stuck together, I was sure I'd be okay. And for her part, I could see determination in Lexi's eyes. Either she needed me close too, or she truly understood just how much I needed her. When the silent conversation came to an end, Lexi nodded toward me, and I echoed the movement with a nod toward Mom. Lexi spoke for both of us. She whispered, "Right, we will." Robert refused to help us move the bed, so Lexi, Mom, and I struggled to get it down the hallway, but it was worth it. We pressed the two twin beds right up close to one another so I could hold her hand as we went to sleep. He didn't raise the issue of our shared bedroom again. That decision to let us stay together was one of many Robert made over the years that made no sense to me. I loathe him. I hate him. But even I can see that Robert is no one-dimensional villain. Allowing Lexi and me to share a room was a surprising concession on a night that was otherwise full of fear and pain and loss. There would be other times over the years that followed when he would catch me off guard with a completely unexpected kindness, like when he gave Lexi money for my rehab one time, and the fact that he has allowed Mom to speak to us via the phone, even though it breaks one of the community's most sacred rules, the separation between those in and those of us who are out is supposed to be absolute. But from the beginning of our life with Robert, he was not only our evil stepfather, he was also Mom's husband. And regardless of all of the awful things that he's done to me and to Lexi, on some level, I do believe that Mom loves him. Her life is not one I could bear myself, but her marriage to Robert seems to have made my mother happy. I hate him anyway. Small acts of kindness do not cancel out the many ways he damaged me.
11. Lexi. I know that Sam has a 30-minute break for lunch between surgeries. I find him in his office, where he's reviewing case notes as he eats a sandwich. As soon as I step into the room, he scans my face, then he rises from his desk to pull me into his embrace. I feel anxious and fidgety, like I'm wound too tight inside. I lean into him, expecting comfort at the warmth of his body against mine, and I'm disappointed when it fails to rise. How did the hearing go? Sam asks me, and he pulls me gently away from him to peer down into my face. I search for words, and when they fail me, I sigh and shake my head. Not good. I mean, most of it was as we expected, but the judge came down on her pretty hard. She'll pretty much have to go to that place at Auburn as soon as she's discharged. Sam's eyes are locked on mine.
So, what happens to the baby?
I clear my throat and shake my head as I disentangle myself from Sam altogether. I press my hands deep into the pockets of my jeans to keep them still, and then I stare away at the wall behind Sam's ear as I admit, well, it will stay in the NICU, but once it's discharged, it goes into foster care, or... I clear my throat. Or it stays with me.
With us.
Sam corrects me with a frown.
Lexi, I keep telling you, we're in this together. Do you want to care for the baby while Annie gets better?
That's the thing, Sam, I say, but I still can't look at him. I let my gaze fall to the floor. I don't know if she'll finish that rehab program.
Well, it sounds like she'll have to if she wants the baby back.
It's not that simple. It's never that simple. There's no better way to send Annie off the rails than to insist she do something.
And what happens if she doesn't graduate the program?
They will arrest her immediately, I whisper, and Sam takes me into his arms again and pulls me hard up against himself. He strokes the back of my hair as he says quietly,
"That's a pretty good incentive to play nice while she's in there, honey."
It's like there's a switch that gets flipped inside her whenever anyone tells her what to do. She automatically does the opposite.
So are you worried that if we take the baby for a few weeks, we'll be stuck with it forever?
Stuck with it? Sam winces and shakes his head.
That came out wrong, but you know what I mean. We are certainly capable of caring for a newborn for a few weeks. We can call it practice.
He offers me a smile, but the one I give him in return is forced.
But if you really think she's not going to give rehab a shot, even with the future of her kid in the picture, well, we need to sit down and talk this out, don't we?
I hesitate. Then I whisper, I already told her I'll take the baby.
Lexi!
Sam is shocked, and I'm immediately defensive. She was so upset, and I can't let my niece or nephew go into the foster system. God, that kid is already going to have NAS to deal with when it's born, and...
Sam interrupts. His words are sharp, and I can see impatience in the stiffness of his shoulders and the hard set of his jaw. Look, we'll make it work. I just wish you'd talk to me before you agreed to this. Have you even thought about your job? You can't take indefinite time off. You told Oliver you'd be back on Monday. How are we going to juggle all of this, especially if it does end up being for the longer term?
I will go back to work on Monday, I say. And he let Ira take 3 months off last year when he and his partner adopted that baby from China. I'll look into unpaid parental leave. And if they won't let me do that, we could get a nanny. I'll find a way to make it work.
Lexi, I know you will. You are the most capable woman I know. But we are going to be in this together. That means you don't have to deal with it on your own, but it also means... Sam draws in a deep breath, then he groans impatiently.
Well, frankly, it means that I do have to deal with it, too. And you need to talk to me before you make decisions like this. Got it? I feel my face flushing, but I nod silently. I hate this, and I'm completely mortified that it's happening. I hate that Sam is inconvenienced by Annie, just as I am, just as I always am. She's my problem, she's my burden to bear, my responsibility. Sam is still frustrated. I can see it in the way he's holding himself, and even in the way he's avoiding my gaze now as he processes what I've done. Just as I feel defensiveness rising, he glances at me, and his tone is gentler as he says,
"We're going to figure all of this out, okay? Let's talk some more over the weekend. The baby's not going to come for weeks. There's plenty of time to make a plan."
I nod and take a step backward away from him. "You should eat your lunch, and I need to get back to her."
"I'll come by your room when I'm done."
"I'll just meet you at home," I say. "I'm not sure how long I'll be here today."
Sam's brow furrows. As I register the lingering displeasure in his gaze, guilt sweeps over me, and I just can't face him any longer.
I offer him a weak smile, but then leave his office quickly to return to Annie. Less than 48 hours have passed since Annie returned to my life,
and even my relationship with Sam already feels off-kilter. Knowing I'll be back at work on Monday, I decide to spend the weekend with Annie. I rise early and wander quietly through the house, packing a box with things that she and I can do to fill the time over the day. And then I stop off at a diner. "Hey," I greet Annie warmly, when I finally step into her room. I have the box under one arm, with the milkshake and coffee I ordered at the diner balanced precariously on top. And in my other hand is a paper bag full of sweet treats for her. Annie has always had such a sweet tooth. "Oh, hi." She stabs at the remote control on her lap, and the television she'd been watching powers down. "What are you doing here so early?" "I'll go back to work on Monday. I thought we could hang out." "Don't you have a real weekend to look forward to? I'm sure that oh-so-together fiancé of yours has some plans I'm getting in the way of. Golf or polo, perhaps? Or a day at the country club?" Her barb hits closer to the truth than she realizes. Sam loves to play golf, and we joined a country club together last year. "All I'm doing this weekend is catching up with you," I tell her firmly, and I awkwardly angle the box beneath my arm toward her. She removes the milkshake and the coffee and rests them both on the table over her bed. I walk to the corner of the room to dump the box onto the larger table, and as I release it, I immediately pick up the untouched bag of baby clothes I brought the previous morning. My intentions were good, but Annie was simply too upset to look through the clothes with me after the hearing. Maybe today will be a better time. I return to sit at the end of her bed and watch as Annie's face brightens when she opens the bakery bag. But then she hesitates. "Is this stuff okay for me to eat? They said low sodium, so..." "It's definitely not low sugar, but it should all be low sodium," I assure her. And once again, I'm surprised by the care she's taking. Maybe I shouldn't be. After all, it's natural for a mother to want to do the best by her child. Then again, this particular mother has spent the first 8 months of her pregnancy injecting illicit narcotics into her veins on a regular basis. And just like that, I'm judging her again. From admiration to condemnation in two simple thoughts. It never really goes away. "You feeling okay?" I ask her, and she shrugs and tears open a cinnamon bun. "I'm feeling scared," she murmurs after a while. "It's okay to be scared. I never meant to get pregnant. The baby's father, he's not a great guy. He's in prison now, but he was my dealer," she says, and then she clears her throat. "I didn't realize I was pregnant, not for a long time. I've been such a mess. The days and weeks and months meant nothing until I felt it moving. Then I knew. And I felt bad in my life, guilty, I mean, but never like that." "How are the cravings, Annie?" I ask her gently, and she laughs bitterly and shakes her head. "Which answer do you want, Lexi? The one where I tell you what I'm supposed to tell you, or the honest one?" "The honest one." "How many times a minute does my heart beat?" I glance at the monitor beside her bed, and I say, "At the moment, about 82. "In that case, I probably only think about getting high 5 or 10 times every heartbeat." "The methadone should be taking the edge off it." "Oh yeah, the methadone." She snorts, and then takes a long sip of the milkshake. "They're split dosing me, so I have it morning and night. I already figured out if I'm going to bust out of here and score, the best time to do it would be in the evening just before the night dose." "You wouldn't feel it anyway. Not like you normally do. The methadone is an antagonist. It stops the high," I tell her, and I feel my face flushing and wish I hadn't asked. I don't know why I'm so embarrassed by this discussion. Perhaps it's because I wasn't expecting her to answer me. Annie was never this open with me about her addiction. It was always something she juggled in the shadows. I've spent as much time trying to get her to speak openly about it as I have dealing with the fallout of her trying to keep it secret. And it has a long half-life. Even on a split dose, the methadone would be in your system from the morning dose. "I know you're a doctor and all, but I know that much better than you do," she tells me. Remember when I was at your place on Wilder Street? You dragged me to the methadone clinic yourself before work each day, and you watched me take it. I didn't miss a dose. And then you'd go to work, and I'd score. It gave me no rush, no buzz. I did it out of pure, unbreakable habit. I need the rush. So even if I know I'm physically incapable of feeling it, I'll still chase it as long as there's breath in my body. Remember that job I had doing web content for the accountants near our house, and I quit after a week? I didn't quit. I got fired because I took money from the petty cash for a hit. The best you can hope for from me is that I'll hide the cravings because I'll never beat them. Why are you telling me this, Annie? Is it to shock me? Or because you want help? Neither, she says, and her shoulders slump, and she seems to shrink away to nothing in an instant. She gives a heavy, lengthy sigh. Then she looks at me, and her eyes are glistening with tears. I guess I just want you to understand. They can chain me to this bed. They can give me methadone. God, they could sedate me out cold. And on some level, I'll still be thinking of scoring. Before anything else, life or death for me or even my baby, I'll always be thinking of scoring. That's who I am now. That is not who you are, I say flatly. I don't ever want to hear you say that again. You can get well. I know you can. You love this baby, Annie. I've seen it in your eyes. It's the only reason you called me at all. I do. I love it so much, it terrifies me, she admits, and her voice cracks and her face contorts. I'm so scared I'm gonna fuck all of this up. You are not, I tell her firmly, and I reach into the bag of baby clothes and I withdraw a handful. Enough of this talk. We're going to fix this, all of it, bit by bit, piece by piece. We're going to put your life back together. But this weekend, you and I are going to reconnect. We're going to put the past 2 years behind us, and we're going to have some fun, starting right now. Look at these booties, Annie. Look at them. I thrust them toward her, and when she doesn't reach for them, I toss them onto her belly. They are tiny. I got the premature baby size and everything, because we know her baby is very small. And these booties look like they were made for a doll. Annie reaches down with shaking fingers and slips her forefinger under the tie that holds the shoes together. She gives a teary laugh. They're so small. In a few weeks, we're going to slip those onto the feet of a baby. A baby! Can you imagine its little toes all snug and warm in there? God, it's going to be so adorable. I dump the handful of clothes onto the bed beside Annie's thighs, and she hesitantly begins to riffle through them. All of the clothes I bought are white or yellow or green, except a single pink and blue outfit. Do you remember the doll we had at Winterton? She asks me, and I frown at her and shake my head. Doll? Never mind, she says, and she leans forward suddenly and places her hand over mine. I look at her in surprise, and she squeezes hard and whispers, "Thank you, Lexi." Our eyes lock. This mess of a woman is what's left of my baby sister. She looks 20 years older than she is, and I've never understood how it came to this, and maybe I never will. I love her anyway. Near or far, broken or whole, I love my sister more than anything else in the world, and somehow, no matter what she does or what comes between us, I always will. There is no off switch to the love between sisters, no way to pause it, no way to destroy it. Even when I pushed her away 2 years ago, I did it only because I thought it was the best thing I could do for her at the time. Oh, what I wouldn't give to make her life whole. What I wouldn't give to see her thriving and healthy and functional. What I wouldn't give to see her at peace. If only there was a way to free up all of that beautiful mental energy that she expends thinking constantly about that fucking high. She could change the world with the potential wasting away in that mind, that wild imagination, that crisp creativity. Annie Vidler was never meant to become this disaster. She should have been a poet or a novelist or a philosopher or a journalist. And instead of sitting here by her bedside now lamenting the world she inhabits, I should have been watching her win awards and enjoy a life of space to create. It's too much, and it's too heartbreaking. I wrestle my thoughts back to the present, and I point to the cinnamon bun that Annie is holding. "Eat it," I tell her after I clear my throat. "We're going to play Monopoly." We weren't allowed to play board games in the community. Someone had decreed them as worldly at some point. But in the years before, Annie and I played all of the time. I usually threw the game for Annie because if I didn't, she didn't stand a chance of winning. She had this terrible habit of buying every property she landed on. No strategy, always relied on luck. Typical Annie. I had a strategy for Monopoly, one honed after years of games with Dad after Annie went to bed. Dad played an ad hoc game, much like Annie, and I never got tired of the way he would throw his hands up in surrender and grumble about losing. But there was a gleam in his eye, as if he secretly loved losing to me. That's exactly how I felt about playing with Annie. I wanted her to win. So every move of the game was the opposite to my winning strategy. I'd buy single properties and pass up opportunities to get the whole color. I'd never buy the railroads or the more expensive properties. I'd go to jail and sit there, trying to roll double figures, and I'd tell her it was because I wanted to save the $50. Annie still approaches the game as if she's 6 years old. She squeals with delight when she gets a chance card, and she grins mischievously when she enforces the rent charges. But the game doesn't matter. It's just a vehicle, something to focus our attention on. The important part of the morning is our conversation between turns. "So, tell me about Sam," Annie asks at one point. "What do you want to know?" "Where'd you meet him?" "At a lecture on keyhole surgery. I held back after to ask him a question about a particular patient, and we started chatting." I smile at the memory. I had no ulterior motive when I approached Sam, but it was only moments into our chat that I started to wonder if there was something there. He asked if I wanted to meet up with him for coffee later that day. Things kind of fell into place from there. "Do you think it's a coincidence that you found your first long-term partner as soon as you threw me out?" It takes a moment for me to recognize the guilt in her voice, and when I do, I glance at her in surprise. "Of course it is, Annie," I say gently. "Not so sure." Annie shrugs, and she rolls the dice in silence as I ponder her simple statement. She lands on yet another random property and immediately reaches for her cash. Annie now owns a good portion of the board, but still no complete color sets. And she's still excited to be adding still another color to her collection. How could it be anything other than a coincidence? "I've taken a lot of your energy over the years, Lex."
"So has my training," I point out.
"Yeah," Annie concedes. Then she passes me the dice. "Plus, you know, there's something about Sam," I say softly. I'd never met anyone who fit me the way Sam does. He gets me. We have the same tastes, the same interests, the same patterns and routines and habits and, I mean, we have plenty of differences too, trust me, but we fit perfectly on all of the key things, you know? I never really believed in the one, but Sam makes me happy, and I think I make him happy too. I dated a bit when I was studying, but no one ever checked the boxes the way Sam does.
That's nice, Lex.
That's really nice. I can hear her jealousy, and it feels awkward to acknowledge it to myself. When we argued over the years, she'd always accused me of thinking I'm perfect, but she's wrong about that. I don't. I'm achingly aware of my flaws,
my need to control my own life was a huge barrier to my relationship with Sam in the early days. I felt like he was too perfect for someone like me. Like my baggage was immense enough to be an insurmountable wall between us. It has taken 2 years of very hard work to get my relationship with Sam to the place it is now, and 2 long years to convince myself that I do deserve happiness. The guilt I feel at having failed to help Annie until now has been like a creeping vine winding its way through my entire life at times. I roll the dice and buy the electric company I land on. Then I pass the dice back to Annie as I ask hesitantly, "And you said the baby's father was in prison?" "His name is Dale. And yes, there was a sting. Just after I became pregnant, I guess. He was with a bunch of guys we know. They had a shitload of gear on them, splitting it up to sell. I don't think he was actually the kingpin the DEA said he was, but he got 20 years. "Does he know about the baby?" "I did send him a letter. He didn't write back. But the thing is, Dale has a bunch of kids he pretty much ignores already. And we weren't exactly in love, so I think I can say with reasonable confidence that his interest level in this baby is bound to be low." Annie snorts as if she's angry, but her eyes fill with tears. "I should have had an abortion, maybe. But I knew it was probably too late anyway, and I don't know. I was kind of excited. I just thought everything would work itself out better than it has. I've gotten off the smack before, you know. I thought this time I could stay off if I was doing it for the baby. I tried a bunch of times to get clean, but the sickness seemed to come earlier, and it was more intense than I'd remembered. I tried again last week. That's when my feet swelled up. I thought it was just the withdrawals, but then I took a hit and it didn't get better. That's when I called you. And about the baby, were you imagining that you'd raise it alone then?" I ask her. Then add hesitantly, in that trailer? Annie raises her eyebrows at me. "Like this would be the only kid in Alabama raised in a trailer?" "It's not ideal." "Nothing in life is ideal, Lexi. I thought if I could get my shit together, I could get a job and we'd be okay." I decide to drop the subject, although the urge to point out to her how unprepared she seems is almost overwhelming. What I've just gleaned from this conversation is that Annie does not have a plan, that she is just assuming things are going to magically get better, and she's probably expecting that I'll be the magic bean that solves all of her problems. I clamp down the resentment I feel. I want to connect with her today. I can't let my indignation get in the way of that. "Do you hear from Mom much?" Annie asks me now, and I shake my head. "No, I call her every few months." We both ponder this quietly for a moment. Then I ask her, "So, given everything, have you thought more about when you might want to call her to talk to her about the baby?" "Maybe soon. Next week, maybe, once the dust settles." "Okay. You know, this hospital has its own entertainment system in the TV, like a fancy hotel." "Yeah?" "Yeah. Last night I was flicking through it, and I saw they have Back to the Future. Remember when we watched that with Dad?" I laugh softly. "I remember we had an argument over which one of us was going to marry Michael J. Fox when we grew up." "Oh, yeah," she laughs. "I forgot about that. Let's watch it again when we finish this game, for old time's sake." The TV is mounted to the ceiling above Annie's bed and hangs at an angle, so that someone lying close to flat could still see the screen. It's hard to see the TV from the visitor's chair. About 10 minutes into the movie, Annie glances at me and notices the awkward way I'm sitting, and she shuffles awkwardly to the edge of her bed and pats the mattress. "Sit up here," she says. "I can see fine," I assure her. "Suit yourself." She shrugs, then adds a little bitterly, "I'm sure you can afford a fancy chiropractor to fix it if you fuck your neck up sitting like that. You'd probably rather hurt yourself than actually share a mattress with a filthy junkie like me." "Annie,"
I groan, and I stand and slide onto the bed. I lean into the pillows and stretch my legs out, then I slide my arm around her shoulders, pulling her close. She sits stiffly, still offended. Don't do that. Don't assume I think those things about you. You're my sister. Those things are true, though, she mutters, and I contract my arm around her. Would you stop jabbering for 5 minutes so I can relive my childhood fantasies about Marty McFly? Hands off, bitch, she says lightly. You've got Sam. Marty McFly is all mine. We both chuckle, and then she drops her head, resting it against my shoulder. Eventually, she falls asleep like that, and as her breathing deepens, I feel myself start to relax too. I press my cheek against her hair, and I rest too, somehow complete again, as if a part of myself has been missing for all of this time.
12. Annie. So, Luke, there were few saving graces in Winterton, but chief among them once again was Lexi. She was so much smarter than I, and she quickly figured out how to roll with the punches in that place. I was still fighting to go back to our old school even months after we arrived, but Lexi quietly agreed to attend the community school and set about getting through the curriculum as quickly as she could. Mom kept reminding her, as a girl in the community, she could study only until she turned 16. What's she going to do after that? I asked one day. She's already doing some high school curriculum, isn't she? Will she finish it by then? It doesn't matter whether she finishes or not. The day she turns 16, she'll have to leave. That's so stupid, Mom. Women should care for their homes and the men. They don't need to study more than that. Even you went to college. That was a mistake. Lexi will finish school on her birthday, and she'll get a job with one of the village businesses until she finds a husband. When I asked Lexi what she thought about all of this, she'd shrug and change the subject. I figured that she had a plan, because there was no way someone as smart as my sister was going to just agree to stop school because she didn't happen to be a boy. Every good thing in that place had a downside. Mom finally went back to work, but now she was my teacher. And when we were at school, I was supposed to call her Mrs. Herbert. Every time I called her Mom, she sent me out of class. Then I found the library, which was vast and right near our house. But even as I explored it, I realized that most of the books were theological textbooks, and the handful of novels in the collection were classics for adults. Why aren't there any books here? I asked Lexi. The elders think said novels are worldly. She rolled her eyes. What are we supposed to read? I asked, bewildered. Lexi picked up one of the ever-present Bibles and pressed it toward me. When I frowned at her, she laughed and withdrew it. But just write your own stories, she suggested. Your stories are better than anything you'll find in this stupid cult. For a while, that's what I did. I had little notepads full of stories hidden in our bedroom and in my school bag. I'd slide them inside workbooks so when I was bored in class, I could get right back to them. I was writing a series of tales about two orphaned sisters, Tara and Ellen, who were detectives just like Nancy Drew. Day and night, I was thinking about Tara and Ellen. They were all alone in the world, but they were doing okay. One Saturday afternoon, Lexi and I were in our bedroom talking when Robert threw the door open. What is this? He asked, and he threw one of my notepads onto the desk beside me. I looked to Lexi. It's mine, she said. It's just some stories I made up, no harm done.
Yours?
He repeated scornfully.
Alexis, your handwriting would be neater than this even if you wrote it with your left hand. No, there's only one person in this family with a letter formation of a preschooler and an overactive imagination.
They're just stories, Father, Lexi protested. It's harmless. Robert turned his attention from Lexi to me, and he crouched beside me and held the notebook right in front of my face. I recognized it then. It was the book that contained the story of how Tara and Ellen escaped from an icy prison cell after being captured by an evil horse wrestler. As an adult, I can see that the symbolism wasn't exactly subtle,
but at the time, I couldn't actually understand Robert's fury.
There must be something very wicked about you indeed for you to need to make up nonsense like this.
He whispered fiercely, and he held a notebook right in front of my face. I raised my chin stubbornly, holding his gaze, and he tore the notepad into two even pieces. I didn't even let myself blink.
Focus your energies on the Lord and learning your Bible. If I catch you doing this again, there'll be consequences. Do you hear me?
Yes, Robert, I said, and his gaze narrowed. He left the room but returned quickly with a leather strap from the dining room. I was already well aware by that stage that my disobedience inevitably resulted in serious consequences. The leather belt hung on the wall near the dining room table, and during our first few weeks in his house, Robert had taken it down to fling it against my thighs when I didn't say amen after grace. That day, he lashed me for forgetting to say father, and then he lashed me again for hiding the notebooks, and then for extra good measure, he hit Lexi, too, for her insolence. Neither one of us cried until he left the room, and then, nursing our stinging thighs, we lay on our stomachs on our beds, and we offered each other empty consolations. I'll still keep my notebooks, I said. I'll just be more careful to hide them. Maybe a better idea would be to keep making up your stories, but don't leave any evidence lying around, Lexi muttered. Just tell them to me instead. It's going to get better, isn't it, Lex? Sure it is. He's still getting used to us. He'll back off soon. Sorry he hit you. I'm really sorry he hit you. Mom wasn't kidding when she told us we had dozens of cousins within the community. We met a seemingly endless series of relatives we had no clue existed before the move. But we had almost nothing in common with them, not even with the kids our own age. The children who grew up in the community were compliant and quiet, well accustomed to the strict discipline and dogmatic rules. As outsiders, Lexi and I were also excluded. I overheard an aunt explaining our odd ways to her 10-year-old son.
They can't help it, son. They were raised in a world of sin.
I had no idea what this meant as an 8-year-old, only that it wasn't a nice thing to say, and that it somehow explained why even the friends I made at the schoolhouse kept their distance. It seemed the more familiar I became with the community, the more I realized just how much there was to hate. But there was a window of time each day when no one really seemed to care what Lexi and I did. Without TV and with limited reading material available, we were supposed to stay in our rooms after school to study the Bible or pray. But we quickly figured out that as long as we weren't bothering the adults, kids were left to do whatever they pleased in the afternoons. Most stayed at the schoolyard to play. But as outcasts, Lexi and I attempted that only a few times before we realized that we weren't welcome. So instead, we took to exploring. The woods had been cleared when the village was established, but a small patch of wilderness had been left untouched behind the worship hall. Robert's house was only a few hundred yards away, so Lexi and I would quietly disappear into the trees. The first few times we tried it, we weren't sure if we were breaking some unspoken rule, and we were so nervous about being caught that we just sat on rocks and waited for the axe to fall. But as the days passed and our trips to the woods went undetected, Lexi and I began to relax. She was far too old by then for make-believe, but I needed it. I needed to escape, and there were no books for me to lose myself in and no TV shows to zone out into, and even the boisterous fun play I'd always enjoyed with my school friends had disappeared from my life. One day, sitting there in the woods, I turned to my sister and I blurted, "Can we play mommies and daddies?" And Lexi, the smartest kid I'd ever met, well into puberty by that stage, and more mature in so many ways even than our mother, stared at me. After a while, she nodded thoughtfully, and then she said, "Deal, but only if I can be the mom."
13. Lexi. I'm on to my fourth consult Monday morning when the phone on my desk rings. "Please excuse me," I say to my patient, and I pick up the handset. "Yep?" "Hi, Lexi. We've had a call from the hospital. Your sister's condition has changed. They suggested you come right in." The receptionist is hesitant and apologetic. "What happened? What did they say?"
That's all, but it sounded urgent.
I hang up and I turn to the patient. I've forgotten her name. I know she's here to get her antidepressant script refilled. Where were we up to? I try to flash her a calm smile, but I know I failed to hide my state of mind when she says hesitantly, "Dr. Vidler, are you okay?" I look to the screen. Carrie Nichols. Have I already asked her about side effects? How long has she been taking these meds? Is it time to review her dosage? What other medication is she on? Is she still depressed?
Your sister's condition has changed. They suggested you come right in. It sounded urgent.
I've forgotten my patient's name again. I look at the screen. Carrie Nichols. I can't make a decision about her medication now. Panic has wrecked my concentration. I'm really sorry, Nicole, I say. There's been an emergency.
It's Carrie,
she corrects me, and she's confused and annoyed as I rise. I'm really sorry, I say again. I have to go. Please reschedule your appointment. There'll be no fee for these consultations. I can't leave her alone in my office, so I have to stand at the door while I hurry her out. Then I run to the staff room. I unlock it with my swipe key and think of Annie and the time she used this very swipe key to try to rob this place, and how that almost ruined my career. And here I am using it 2 years later to run out to her. But what if she's really sick? And what if the baby is in trouble? It must be bad for them to ask me to come right in. Or does the staff at the hospital not realize I'm working? And how many people will be inconvenienced by this?
What do you want us to do with your patients, Lexi?
The receptionist asks at the door as I'm pulling my jacket on. I look at her blankly, then say, I'm going to have to reschedule all of them. All of them. I'm so sorry. I don't think I'll be back today. Please tell the patients I'll do all of their consults for free when they return. And please tell Oliver he can take it out of my salary. And please,
Lexi, it's going to be okay.
I'll squeeze your emergency patients in with someone else, and I'll talk to Oliver and tell him what happened, okay?
Just go to the hospital.
The receptionist interrupts me, apparently having had enough of my anxious ramblings. I speed all the way to the hospital, and I double park behind Sam's dedicated parking space when I finally arrive. I run through the halls to maternity, but her room is empty. So I run straight back to slam my palms down on the reception desk and ask the nurse behind it, Where is Annie? Annie Vidler.
Are you Lexi?
Yes, what's going on? Another nurse appears. She's carrying a set of surgical scrubs, and my stomach drops all the way to my toes.
She's being prepped for surgery, the nurse murmurs as she passes me the scrubs. They're going to do a C-section. Dr. Rogers is just securing consent.
Consent? I repeat, and the nurse nods. She's on the phone with the baby's guardian ad litem. As soon as he gives a go-ahead, she's going to start, so we need to hurry. I can hear my pulse in my ears. Annie wasn't even allowed to consent to her own C-section, and that is maddening. But that's not even the issue that matters most. Something has obviously changed with Annie's condition, and for these drastic measures, it must be serious. What happened? I ask as I follow the nurse to a bathroom. The baby went into distress. I'm not sure of the details. I pull the scrubs on in record time and run through the corridor after the nurse to the operating room. Annie is on the table, the epidural already administered, and Eliza is behind a curtain, preparing for the surgery. I have made it just in time, and I can't believe that the peaceful weekend I spent with my sister has given way to this rush of chaos. Annie is sobbing, and I'm desperate to know why this C-section is being done, but I don't want to ask until I calm her down. I take my place beside her face and perch upon the stool that a nurse hastily presses in my direction. Everything is going to be absolutely fine, Annie. Just try to stay calm.
But they said the baby was in distress.
Annie is panicking, and I can hear the too fast rhythm of her heart on the monitor. I squeeze her shoulder and force an entirely artificial smile. Let's take some deep breaths, okay? I'll take them with you. Let's breathe in. Annie locks her eyes onto mine and inhales deeply, then exhales with me. After a few breaths, she closes her eyes and then nods to herself.
I'm okay. I'm okay, Lexi. Of course you are, I whisper to her, and then I stand briefly to glance over the curtain. Eliza is moving very quickly.